Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 30th, 2017, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special courthouse steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss redistricting. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest Hans von Spakovsky to Teleform. He is the manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C. He's going to give us some background on the case and then on the decision, about 15 or 20 minutes of opening remarks, after which we'll be turning to the audience for questions. So please do be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, the floor is yours, Hans von Spakovsky.
Well, Dean, thank you very much, and I do appreciate the Federal Society inviting me back. We are obviously towards the end of the Supreme Court's term, and so we are starting to get final decisions from the court in many cases. And on May 22nd, the court released another redistricting case out of North Carolina, Cooper v. Harris. And I say another because there have been so many redistricting cases before the Supreme Court out of North Carolina in recent years that even Justice Alito, in the dissent that he wrote, remarked on the fact that just one of the two congressional districts that was at issue in this case, District 12, that this was its fifth appearance before the court. So lawyers in North Carolina, those representing the state, those who have sued the state, have been before the court on numerous occasions. I think actually that is a illustrative of the fact that the law governing redistricting, and in particular the Voting Rights Act and the Equal Protection Clause, and what a state can and can't do in this area is frankly very chaotic. The rules laid out by the Supreme Court are very broad. They are very confusing. And I'm afraid that this decision isn't really going to clarify things for lawyers in the redistricting field. And this decision comes out at a time when we are really not too far away from an entirely new round of redistricting, which is going to occur after the next census in 2020. So what was at issue in the Harris case was two congressional districts in North Carolina that had been redrawn, District 1 and District 12. And again, we should point out these were redrawn based on 2010 census data. So 7 years after the 2010 census, we still don't know what the actual and viable congressional redistricting map will be in the state of North Carolina. And again, I think this illustrates the confused status of the law. What happened in these two districts, and again here, I think it's important for people to understand the numbers involved, was that Congressional District 1 was a district that had a black voting age population of 48.6%. That was changed by the state by about 4 percentage points to 52.7 percentage points. It's important to keep in mind that North Carolina did have to add population to its districts because of the growth in North Carolina up until 2010 from the 2000 census. So District 1 increased by about 4 percentage points, went from slightly under having a black voting age population to having a slight majority of a black voting age population. The state also reconfigured District 12, increasing its black voting age population from 43.8% to 50.7%. So you've got about a 7 percentage point increase, so that the district becomes just barely a majority black voting age district. Now, a number of plaintiffs in these districts sued claiming that these were impermissible racial gerrymanders because race was taken into account in an improper way by the state legislature when they drew the districts. And so that brings us into the confused area of the law and what I call the Goldilocks principle of redistricting, because the case law on this from the U.S. Supreme Court is basically this. Race normally cannot be the predominant factor in redistricting because that would violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. This was most graphically described and illustrated in another North Carolina case back in 1993 called Shaw versus Reno, in which the congressional district there looked like a dumbbell with two large districts at each end connected by, in essence, a highway. So in that case, the court said race cannot be the predominant factor in redistricting, but it could be one factor to ensure compliance with the Voting Rights Act. The court said that if race was the predominant factor, then the courts would apply strict scrutiny, and a state had to show that the redistricting plan served a compelling interest and was narrowly tailored to achieve that result. In a second case, it was a second iteration of the Shaw case in 1996, the court said that compliance with the Voting Rights Act is considered to be a compelling interest. Now, in this particular case, the state admitted that it had used race in Congressional District 1 when it increased the district from a little over 48% to a little over 52%. The state said that it had done that in order to comply with the Voting Rights Act to avoid a lawsuit under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. What was interesting about this is, and the claims about Congressional District 12 is that this entire case went through the state court system first. And in the state court system, a state trial court actually rejected the claims that Districts 1 and 12 were unlawful racial gerrymanders. That went all the way to the North Carolina Supreme Court, which affirmed the decision under the state equivalent of clear error review. And yet, you know, here we have basically the same claims being made in the federal courts, and the federal courts coming to the exact opposite conclusion. I think that also demonstrates how fact-intensive these cases are, and also how differently different judges draw conclusions from basically, you know, what may be the same facts. Now, the state said that it had to draw District 1 the way it did, in order to comply with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The court, in a 5-3 decision, rejected that claim and found that both of these districts had were, in fact, impermissible racial gerrymanders. The court went through the tests and steps that you have to go through to have a viable Section 2 lawsuit under the Voting Rights Act. And they said, the majority said, that the state hadn't shown that those requirements were met. In particular, of the three steps of what's called the Thornburg versus Jingles test for a viable Section 2 lawsuit, the state had not shown that the district's white voters would vote sufficiently as a block to help defeat the minority's preferred candidate. In fact, what the court said was that even at 48%, the black voting age population in District 1 had a history of being able to elect its candidate of choice. So there was no reason to put in more black voters into that district. The state said that they were required to do so despite that election history because of a prior case out of North Carolina, Bartlett versus Strickland, in which the Supreme Court had said that the Voting Rights Act does not protect what are called crossover districts. And that's what District 1 was. It was a crossover district. It was not a majority-minority district in which black voters were a majority. It was a crossover district in which a large minority of black voters, with the help of white voters, was able to elect their candidates of choice. While the state admitted that it was trying to comply with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act when it put a larger population of black voters into District 1, it denied that race had played any consideration in the changes to District 12. This is the one that went from about 44% to a little to almost 51% with the black voting age population. There, the state said that this was entirely done for partisan political reasons to help the Republican Party and Republican candidates, that it had nothing to do with race. The majority of the court disagreed with that and said that they believed what the federal district court had found, that in fact race was the predominant factor and thus an impermissible factor in drawing out District 12, to once again illustrate how different judges could come to different conclusions looking at this evidence. The dissenting judges, Justice Alito, the chief, and Justice Kennedy, all said that, in fact, the record showed the Congressional 12 was not drawn due to race. And the fact that the state courts had come to the same conclusion, according to Judge Alito, he said that that finding, quote, illustrates the thinness of the plaintiff's proof. What was also interesting about that was that Alito pointed out a glaring mistake that was made by the federal district court. The federal district court pointed to the statements of two of the state legislators who had led the redistricting effort. They had talked about the fact that they were constructing Voting Rights Act majority black districts, districts with an S, districts plural. And therefore, the federal district court judge said, well, that showed that both Congressional District 1 and Congressional District 12 had been drawn for racial reasons. The problem was that statement, those two legislators, they weren't referring to the congressional redistricting done by the legislature. They were referring to the state legislative districts that had been drawn. Even the Justice Department that filed an amicus brief in this case on the side of the plaintiffs admitted that the district court had made a mistake in its characterization of the statement. Yet, as Justice Alito points out, that mistake was entirely ignored by Justice Kagan and the majority when they wrote their majority opinion. The other problem in this case, and this is something that Justice Alito points out, is that it is really difficult for courts to determine if legislators are redrawing a district for racial versus partisan reasons. The reason being, and this is a straight quote from Alito, quote, if around 90% of African-American voters cast their ballots for the Democratic candidate, as they have in recent elections, a plan that packs Democratic voters will look very much like a plan that packs African-American voters. And that, of course, that quote from Alito illustrates the problem in these kinds of cases, because under the law, political gerrymanders are perfectly acceptable. You know, if a state legislature wants to either pack Democrats or pack Republicans, as long as they comply with the one person, one vote standard, they can do that. That's perfectly legitimate, but packing African-Americans for racial reasons is not. But when there is such a monolithic voting block of African-Americans voting for the Democratic Party, it's often difficult to distinguish between one or the other. And distinguishing that is important so that the Voting Rights Act is not used as it was intended to stop racial discrimination, but instead is used to achieve political ends. And that is something that we need to make sure does not happen with the Voting Rights Act. The other problem with this case, and again, it's something that is going to cause confusion, I think, to all of the lawyers out there who are going to be involved in these redistricting cases in 3 years, is that there's a prior case, it's called the Cromartie case, in which the Supreme Court set a precedent in which they said this: if plaintiffs are challenging a political redistricting with a claim that it is a racial gerrymander, an impermissible racial gerrymander, well, part of what they have to do in proving the case is to present an alternative redistricting plan, an alternative plan that not only will achieve the same political purposes that the legislature said it was trying to get, and political purposes and an alternative plan that is consistent with traditional redistricting principles, but they also have to show that the alternative plan would have brought about a significantly greater racial balance. The plaintiffs in this case did not submit an alternate plan to the congressional plan that was being challenged. Yet the majority, in the opinion written by Kagan, ruled for the challengers despite the fact that they had not met that prior problem. This led to one of the harshest criticisms by Justice Alito in the dissenting opinion, in which he said this: a precedent of this court should not be treated like a disposable household item, say a paper plate or a napkin, to be used once and then tossed in the trash. But that is what the court does today in its decision. The court junks a rule adopted in a prior, remarkably similar challenge to this very same congressional district. And that, in fact, is what made this the most interesting, was that that rule, the challengers have to present an alternative plan, was in a prior case involving this very same congressional District 12. So the Goldilocks rule remains in place. You can't use too much race. You can't use too little race. You have to use just the right amount of race. But what we don't know is whether the Cromartie rule remains in place, that you also have to present an alternative plan. The court just didn't pay any attention to that in this case, even though it's a prior rule of the court. So it's unclear whether they're going to apply that in future cases. I guess I would end with this, and I think this is something that everyone needs to keep in mind, because it's really a good warning given by Alito. He says the majority's opinion threatens to transform federal courts, quote, into weapons of political warfare, close quote. He says that unless the courts exercise extraordinary caution in, quote, distinguishing race-based redistricting from politics-based redistricting, then they will invite the losers in the redistricting process to seek to obtain in court what they could not achieve in the political arena. Now, it's important to note that Justice Thomas did join the four generally liberal members of the court in the majority opinion, but if you read his dissenting opinion, his concurring opinion, which is very short, it's only about a page and a half, it's because he actually believes that race should never be allowed in the redistricting process. He doesn't believe it should be allowed as one factor in the redistricting process. He believes that it violates the Equal Protection Clause. And he does not believe that Section 2 of the Voting Rights actually applies to vote dilution cases. This is an important point because Section 2 originally was passed with the intent of stopping and preventing laws which actually kept individuals from registering, kept individuals out of the polls, kept individuals from voting. And it really in recent years, it has pretty much devolved into a statute used for vote dilution cases. So these are not cases where individuals are prevented from registering or voting. It's cases where they are arguing that their vote is somehow being diluted and doesn't have the same strength or power as other voters. And Justice Thomas makes it clear in his concurrence that he does not believe Section 2 should be applied to vote dilution cases, because that was not the original intent or idea of the statute. So I'd be happy to answer questions from the audience.
Very good. Thank you. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for a guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see who might ring in, a quick announcement about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. It's tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be covering two en banc cases argued recently in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, one case involving the use of administrative law judges by the Securities and Exchange Commission, another case on the constitutionality of the CFPB. Today, of course, it's all about redistricting. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask first to get things started here, Hans. Judge Gorsuch on the court when the decision was rendered, not there when it was argued. Would his participation have made much of a difference in your mind?
You know, I think it would have ended up as a, instead of a 5-3 decision, I think it would have ended up as probably as a 5-4 decision. I believe his history and prior work, he probably would have agreed and joined the dissent written by Justice Alito, joined by the Chief and Justice Kennedy. So I think in the end, we would have had the same result, just a little bit change in the numbers of the votes.
So I'm curious. I mean, you use the word confusion a lot, which I think is right. There seems to be real ambivalence on the court when it comes to redistricting and drawing lines between political gerrymandering and racial intent in gerrymandering, or gerrymandering by race. That seems to extend to voter ID laws too, in my mind, in some ways, where it's hard to see a clear rule emerging. Is there, I mean, have you given any thought to a better path forward, a way to get around the confusion that seems to result in these two areas?
Well, I have to tell you, I have great sympathy for Justice Thomas's view about Section 2 being applied to vote dilution cases. The lawyers involved in these cases know that they are extremely complex, and proving a Section 2 lawsuit involves not just these three requirements set out by the Thornburg versus Jingles Supreme Court case, but then you have to take into account the totality of the circumstances, and that's defined by a set of 10 factors laid out by a congressional conference report when the Section 2 was amended. All of that leads to a very confused state of whether or not a Section 2 violation has occurred. And, you know, it's this weird hybrid of an in between a straight out intent requirement or a straight out effects test where you don't have to show any intent. It's somewhere in between where, well, you don't have to necessarily show intent, but you do have to show a causal connection between prior bad behavior in the racial area, prior problems with, for example, socioeconomic differences caused by racial discrimination. And frankly, the eye is often in the beholder. You know, individuals who have cases like this and states who are defending them often have to hire historians on each side to talk about the history of the state and how or why that would either lead to a Section 2 violation or not lead to a Section 2 violation. And you often get these experts with diametrically opposed views of what's going on. It's in those situations where it's really difficult for state legislators to be able to figure out what they can and can't do. It's really problematic for American citizens, including legislators, when the law is so confusing and so ambiguous that no one reading a law can easily tell whether or not they are violating it or are in compliance with it. That's not the way the law should be.
Once again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We start today with two questions, so let's go to our first caller.
Hey, Hans. Jack Park. Thanks a lot. One observation. The Senate factors are from 1982, so at 35 years, I think they've reached the wear-out date for their utility because things have changed so substantially throughout the South, where they have particular applicability. But my question is this: looking forward, one of the districts was at 43% black voting age population. If you have to repopulate it and you cannot add significantly more African American voters than white voters, because that's racial gerrymandering, it's a sign of racial gerrymandering, you're going to put white voters in there, and they're likely to be Republicans. And if voting is as racially polarized as the Gingles factor would require, do you think the court's going to be happy if some of these districts get taken down to like 40% and white Republicans start winning them?
No. I certainly don't think the four liberals on the court will be happy with that. But in fact, Jack, you've just put your finger on the whole problem with the Section 2 analysis. And that is, when you're trying to determine whether a particular district, for example, satisfies Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, in other words, it's a district where minority voters are able to elect their candidates of choice, There is no red line number. It could be 42%, it could be 45%, it could be 52%, it could be 60%, because it depends entirely on, and this is what the cases look at, depends on entirely on, for example, the turnout, the history of turnout of black voters in that district. If they generally have had a high turnout in prior elections, well, then you can have lower numbers of black voting age population to district. If it's a district where the turnout of black voters is a lot lower than that, then you have to have a higher percentage. And of course, turnout numbers don't stay static. They change from election to election. So a state, when they're trying to redistrict and figure out how many black voters or other minority voters, because this, of course, covers others such as Hispanics and Asians in different parts of the country, how many voters they should put in a district to meet the Section 2 requirements, it's entirely a guessing game. And those percentages can vary widely from district to district, from state to state, and that's what makes it so difficult to come up with something that everyone is going to agree is legitimate under the law.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Still two questions pending, so let's take another call. Go ahead, caller. You might have your telephone on mute. If you have, if you dialed in from area code 760, your microphone should be live if you take your phone off mute. All right. Maybe a technical problem there, so let's move on to our next caller. Moving to area code 512. Sounds like Texas. Go ahead, caller.
Thank you, Hans. And I wanted to get your thoughts on Justice Kagan's election results-based analysis for racially polarized voting, and what the implication that has for cases up the pipeline. For instance, in the Texas case that'll be coming probably before the court this next term, with regard to Texas 23, where you have the same district that elected a Hispanic Democrat, a Republican, a Hispanic Republican, and an African American Republican, what obstacles that election results-based analysis might prove for plaintiffs who are trying to say that there's racial especially polarized voting that requires changes to that district? And in general, if you've been following the Texas case, what your thoughts were with regard to the impact of Cooper on that case?
Sure. Well, that actually is kind of related to my prior question, the prior question from Jack Park, which is that when experts are looking at the voting history of a particular district, they have to decide which elections to look at. Do they only look at elections inside the county? Do they look at statewide elections? Do they look at federal elections? Because oftentimes you may get radically different results. A black candidate, for example, who is well known locally, may easily cruise to victory, yet voters might choose a national candidate who's a Republican running for president in a national election. Well, which of those elections do you count in trying to determine whether black voters can elect their candidates of choice? That shows the confusion and the description that you just gave of the different election results. And that particular district shows the many different factors that go into whether voters choose for a particular candidate. But it also shows how difficult it is to analyze a particular district to decide whether it satisfies Section 2. And I can tell you this from inside Justice Department experience. The Justice Department inside the voting section has a statistical expert who does exactly this, looks at elections in a particular district to try to decide what percentage of, for example, Hispanic or black voters are needed for them to elect their candidates of choice. And depending on which elections they chose, inside the county or out, what years they chose, whether it was years of federal election or years of local elections, they could come out with totally different conclusions on what the required minority population was in that district. And again, you know, the more you go to looking at an effects test and applying effects test, the more the situation is going to vary and the more difficult it is going to be to have any kind of rational legal rule that people who want to follow the law can follow.
Once again, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. We've got one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Let's take another call. Go ahead, caller. If you have your phone on mute, you need to come off mute in order for us to hear you. The caller from 760, or maybe dial in from another phone. You tried before, but we're not able to hear you, so I apologize. Hans, you mentioned some dispute over the facts here, and Justice Alito and his dissenting opinion takes issue with some of the facts that the court had found. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. Does this happen often? It seems to be a particularly confusing area of law, and if all nine justices agree on the factual record, there still seems to be confusion. But what happens in a case like this where Justice Alito says that the court is, in the majority of the court, in its opinion, is relying on making a factual error, relying on a factual error made in lower court, not addressed in the majority opinion? As a practitioner, are you supposed to assume those facts when advising clients going forward, and what was the tone of Justice Alito's remark there when he mentioned that?
Well, I just think that once again illustrates something I said before, which is the different interpretations given the supposed facts in these kind of Voting Rights Act cases. And Justice Alito was pretty clear that he believed that the majority was totally misinterpreting the factual record with regard to Congressional District 12. The reason I say this often happens in these kind of cases is you can see exactly the same difference of opinion in the voter ID case also coming out of Texas. People may recall a Section 2 lawsuit was filed against the Texas voter ID law. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals last year upheld a finding against that law, and there was a really scathing dissent written by the several justices led by Edith Jones, in which she pointed out that, there was a discussion of an intent by the Texas legislature to discriminate when it passes voter ID law. The federal district court judge had made such a finding. And yet Edith Jones, in essence, said in her dissent that not a single iota of evidence existed anywhere in the entire transcript, and it was thousands of pages of information and data showing that there was no any intent whatsoever by the state legislature to intentionally discriminate on a racial basis by passing this law. That again shows how the same facts, apparently, these judges can come to radically different conclusions, and it's one of the problems with these kind of Voting Rights Act cases where we really are in a very sensitive area, which is the claim of racial discrimination.
Very good. It looks like we've got a couple more questions pending now, so let's take another call.
Thank you. I have a question. This goes to the broader perspective of constitutional law. Ordinarily, you don't have to rely on race predominantly to go to strict scrutiny. If you rely on it at all, you go to strict scrutiny. And also ordinarily, compliance with a statute is not considered a compelling public interest unless the statute itself, in some sense, instantiates the Constitution. Is this an anomaly that will never be addressed by the court? Is it sort of its own little cul-de-sac of constitutional law that's going to go off in its own direction forever? Or do you think there's any pressure on the court to reconcile this area of equal protection with, let's say, affirmative action?
Well, you put your finger actually on a difficult problem. I mean, I have to tell you, I believe that any kind of effects test, as opposed to a requirement that you show intentional discrimination, I frankly think it's unconstitutional. But of course, that's not what the court has said. The best example of a change by the court in trying to draw back a little bit of this, I think, actually is their holding in 2013 in the Shelby County decision. Because remember, in that case, they were talking about Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is a pure effects test. You do not have to show any actual intent to discriminate. And remember, the Supreme Court upheld that law back in, I think, 1966 in the Katzenberger case. But what the court said back then was that, they upheld the constitutionality of Section 5 and the effects test because of the extraordinary circumstances which were then existent in the country. And they were extraordinary circumstances. There was statewide official racial discrimination going on. The court believed Section 5 was needed to prevent that. But look, in 2013, when the Supreme Court basically tossed out Section 4, which is the triggering formula for determining whether Section 5 applies to state or not, they said that you can't have this kind of an extraordinary requirement imposed on the states based on 45-year-old data. You have to show that current conditions justify it. And they very succinctly concluded that Congress had not produced the evidence that the conditions currently would justify such an extraordinary problem. We have the same problem in the affirmative action area. The UT Austin case, University of Texas Austin case, which was recently decided by the court, as you know, the court set up very narrow circumstances under which they will uphold a college or university being allowed to apply race to admissions. I frankly think they decided that case wrongly. It should be totally outlawed, and it's clearly a violation to me of equal protection to allow race to be used at all in college admissions. I actually think the same thing should be true in the redistricting process. But we certainly aren't there yet, and I don't know if we're ever going to get there with the Supreme Court.
Just one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hi, I believe Justice Alito made mention of the unsavory practice of partisan redistricting. And I'm wondering, you know, let's say umbrella over all of these cases that doesn't get a lot of discussion. What I'm wondering is if there was this backdrop for the liberals, at least, that saw, for example, in 2012, Democrats get more votes in the House districts than Republicans did, yet Democrats got, Republicans outdid them 2-1 in seats awarded at the end because of the redistricting. I'm wondering if you foresee a trend toward fixing that. And I'm wondering, you know, since it's basic unfairness we're talking about, even recently it's, 54%, but they're getting 10 seats to 3 or something like that. With 54% of the votes. I'm wondering what other unfairness would be tolerated. For example, would it be tolerated to assign one voting machine per 100,000 voters in Democratic districts, explicitly Democratic, since we're permitting partisanship in the election administration, where there'd be one voting machine for every 250 voters in Republican districts, thus making lines long and reducing turnout? Where is the line drawn in terms of the unfairness, I guess? I'm wondering if you think perhaps that's what the court is moving toward, is just more of a basic justiciability of the unfairness issue.
Well, I think it's important to note that, you know, when faced with the claim that a partisan gerrymander was so partisan that it violated equal protection of the 14th Amendment. The court, in a case called Bias, and this was a case out of Pennsylvania, and it was the facts of the case were basically along those lines. Democrats challenged, saying that they should have more state legislative seats because of the overall vote totals across the state. And in that case, you know, four of the justices said, no, we're not going to get into political gerrymandering because there are no manageable standards in this area. Kennedy agreed with the fact that they were not going to fine for the plaintiffs in that case because he also said, well, there are no manageable standards, but if somebody can come up with some, I would consider it. So far, the court really has refused to get into that. Now, we must point out there are limits to how far you can go with political gerrymandering. And that was demonstrated by a case out of Georgia, actually, some years ago called Cox versus Larios. And in that case, this was a case that went to the 11th Circuit, which upheld it. I think the Supreme Court refused to take it. But in that case, this was a time when Democrats can still control the state legislature. And what they did in that case when they redrew the state legislative districts is that people should know the Supreme Court has basically two rules. When it comes to congressional redistricting, districts have to be drawn up in each state with the populations as equal as possible. Even a 100 or 200 vote difference can generate a violation of the law under that Supreme Court doctrine. But the Supreme Court has always had in place what they call kind of a 10% grandfathering rule for states, which is to say that when states are doing state legislative districts, the court has generally allowed them to have up to a 10% differential in the population of each district, as long as, this is important, those differentials are caused by compliance with traditional redistricting requirements, you know, compactness, contiguity, trying to keep counties and cities together. In the Larios case, the Democratic state legislature redrew the state legislative districts for the legislature in Georgia, and in it they systematically underpopulated Democratic districts and overpopulated Republican districts in order to spread Democratic voters out further so they would have more state legislative seats. The court found that actually to be a violation of equal protection because the systematic overpopulation was in no way and could not be justified by traditional redistricting standards and requirements. And so there they actually did find an equal protection violation. There is a case pending before the court, certain, I think it's been requested out of Wisconsin, in which a Wisconsin judge basically has ignored the precedent of the bias case and has found a political gerrymandering claim to be viable and did so under an academic theory that in a very complex nature goes in and tries to show when a particular political party is underrepresented based on prior elections. I have to tell you, given the confusion and complexity that already exists in redistricting involving racial motivations or intentions, if the court suddenly found these kind of political gerrymandering claims to be viable, I think the courts would be overwhelmed, the federal courts, by political gerrymandering claims. And I think we really would be in danger of what Alito warned of, which is when people lose politically in redistricting, they would then try to use the courts as their arena to change that.
One quick follow-up. The partisan breakdown, you said, is 90% African-American vote goes to Democrats.
Alito said that.
If theoretically the partisan breakdown was 100%, how would that impact any analysis?
I think it would make it.
Because I imagine in some precincts it is 100% at the precinct level, and I imagine there'd be reshuffling of precincts based on that 100%. And I'm wondering if the analysis gets granular enough to reach the precinct level.
Oh, yeah, the analysis does get granular enough to reach the precinct level. But if African Americans voted as a block at 100%, which is true in some districts, is not true nationwide, that just makes the problem that I've talked about even more difficult, which is how do you distinguish between what is considered legally acceptable partisan redistricting and legally unacceptable racial redistricting? It makes it extremely difficult to distinguish between the two, and you have to be able to distinguish between the two because the Voting Rights Act was not designed as a statute to help one particular political party. It was designed as a statute to stop racial discrimination in the voting context, and it should not be used for partisan political purposes.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, caller. Hans, it looks like we've gotten our final question in. Let me come back to you and give you a minute or two to wrap up or express a final thought.
I have to tell you, in a perfect world, I think it would be great if we could take race entirely out of the redistricting process, as well as incumbent protection. I mean, I think it would be terrific if states passed laws that said they're not going to get any racial information on voters. They're not going to get other information on where incumbents live. And the only thing they will be entitled to do is get information that will help them keep communities, cities, towns, counties together as much as possible in order to redistrict and get populations as equivalent as possible. I think that would be a much better world. I think you would still have problems but I don't think you'd have the problems we have now. And of course, one issue that still has only been partially resolved by the Supreme Court, and over which I expect more litigation in the future, is that, you know, remember, the Supreme Court requires equal population as much as possible in the redistricting process. But if you live in a state like Texas, for example, or California, where there are very large numbers of individuals who are not U.S. citizens, whether legal or illegal, that is going to diminish the value of your vote depending on what kind of a district you're in. You know, if you are in a district, if you are in a state where each state legislative district is 100,000 individuals out of the total population, but you live in a district that has 90,000 individuals eligible to vote, and your district next door only has 40,000 individuals eligible to vote, it's pretty clear your vote is being diluted. Your vote is only worth about half that of the district next door. The Supreme Court said that was okay if a state wants to do it. I think the issue now is going to be whether states look at, instead of using total population, using only populations consisting of either U.S. citizens or those eligible to vote. And I think that's a big future question that is unresolved.
Well, my thanks to Hans von Spakovsky for joining us once again on Teleforum. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing the two D.C. Circuit en banc cases. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.